Good evening, everybody. This is Patrick Milliken from the Poison Pen Bookstore, and I've been looking forward to tonight for an awfully long time. We're joined by my good friend Willie Vlotten, amazing musician, songwriter, novelist, an all-around cool guy. Welcome, Willie. It's great to have you on this on our little show here.
Thanks for having me, man. It's good to see your face.
Yeah, it's been, we were just talking a little bit before we got started about just what a wild ass, crazy, surreal year this has been, you know, especially for musicians.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really, I mean, luckily, you know, we don't tour that much, but, you know, I think we tour maybe 3 months a year that, and so we're pretty lucky, but Jesus, it's heartbreaking for all the tour bands and even the guys that are playing like 2-3 nights a week in town places to lose their money and their living and being scared that way. Yeah, it's frightening. For us, it was kind of, we just kind of got together and we made a record, but then we said, let's just sit tight until this all blows over. So we're not in any hurry to do anything, but we're sitting on 2 records right now. So we feel like, yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah, for those of you who don't know, Willie's current band is called The DeLines. And go out, steal, you know, buy it used, get it wherever you can, but get a copy of Colfax, the first album that you guys made. It's just a beautiful album.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, and I love the Imperial too. You have 2 albums in the can?
Well, we have an instrumental record we just finished that's kind of a soundtrack to A Night Always Comes, and then we have our 3rd record, which is called The Sea Drift, and that'll come out next year. Yeah, I really The Sea Drift, we worked on for a year and a half. Like, it's a really toiled over it, and I think it's a cool one. So hopefully people like it. You know,
we'll see. Well, we'll get into talking about literature, books, noir, weirdo music, weirdo ambient music, and whatever else might come up, guitars. But for everybody watching on Facebook, this is Willie's brand new book. And we just got in at the Poison Pen our signed copies, although we're just about sold out. So I'm gonna have to hit you up, Willie, to sign another batch for us. I've been selling the hell out of it.
That's a nice thing to hear.
Yeah, but just a brilliant book. And as always, you know, just a very moving book. And we'll get into that in just a second, and I'll pick your brain about where this particular book comes from. I know it has a somewhat unique story. But let's start the conversation, as most good conversations do, get started with Shane McGowan, because I see Pogue's poster behind you there. Have you happened to see the documentary that's out about him?
No, you know, I haven't seen it yet. You know, I was, you know, I grew up, my dad went to England and bought the top 10 records in England in like 1982 or 3 and gave them to me, which is probably the nicest thing he ever did. And it had The Jam in it, and it had the Pogues. And I love the Pogues because my whole idea of music was to disappear. Like, I just wanted to not live where I lived. And I just wanted to live in a different world. And the Pogues, you did. You lived in this romantic, Shane McGowan, drunken Irish, you know, he's a brilliant lyricist world. Yeah. And so when this record, If I Should Fall from the Grace of God, came out, they had this poster. I forget where I was, but I've had it for 30 years, 35 years or something like that. And I always take it wherever I go. And it's one of the only possessions I haven't lost, because... you know, I just like the band. They meant a lot to me as a kid.
Yeah, his writing is just so, as you say, it's just beautiful writing. In the documentary, which is, I recommend seeing, it's the state he's in is, I mean, it's amazing the guy's still alive, for one thing.
Yeah.
But he talks about his writing, and he said, you know, I write songs about, you know, fucking and fighting and living and dying, you know. And you know, it occurs to me that you do the same on some level. That's the important stuff, right?
You know, the crazy thing, it just made me think, in the first reading I did, never really was in England, and they booked it at, and it was in London, and it was at Shane McGowan's favorite bar where he hung out every night. And my wife, but she was my girlfriend then, she was there with me, and she and I was like, man, I hope Shane McGowan's not here, because he'll make fun of me. I know he'll make fun of me, because I was playing a couple songs too, and I was really nervous. I don't have a lot of confidence as it is, and I was petrified that he'd be there tonight. So I asked her, I go, can you check to see if he's there? And she came back to me. She goes, man, he's in the bar. Shane McGowan's in the bar. He came down. He's gonna watch your reading and you play. Oh, and I about threw up. You know, I was like, I can't handle that. And then, and I go, well, could you stand next to him? And if he says any mean things, can you just hit him? You know, can you just tell him to shut the fuck up if he says anything mean? Because I don't think I could take it. I don't think I could have let that. You know, at that time, man, he was one of my big heroes. And so she stood next to him the whole time, and he said something really nice. And then while I was doing my thing, and then after the show, he came up to me and he stole, like he fake stole the book. Like he kind of picked it up and put it in his coat and gave off his little weird laugh he has. And he kissed my hand. And I swear to God, man, it was like the first time you kiss a girl or something. My whole arm caught on fire. I didn't sleep that whole night. My whole arm, like it was just surreal. I ended up walking around town that whole night saying, how the hell did I get to the place where Shane McGowan kissed my hand? So it was one of the nicest things. And back then he could walk, you know, and he had really soft hands, and he was a good kisser too.
Wow. That's gotta be surreal.
Oh, it was so fun, man. Once in a while you get lucky, and that was just like a lucky night, you know, like if he was in a bad mood or something, or maybe I would have read something he didn't like, it could have turned ugly, but he liked me that night, and I'll take it.
Was that the Filthy McNasties?
Yeah, it was.
Okay, because I don't know if George was on the bill that night, but I know our mutual friend, George Pelicanos, who, by the way, was the first one to hit me to your work many years ago.
He did a reading with them, the band.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, he wasn't there, man. It was just me. I don't think they did it for any other reason except that the bar had readings, and I just got lucky that Shane McGowan was there and he was in a good mood.
That's cool. Let's see here. Well, I mean, just to kind of amble our way towards the new book, I wanted to ask you just a couple of basic questions for people who might not know your stuff. I know there are a few out there, but where did you grow up? I know you've ended up in Oregon for much of your adult life, but where did you grow up?
I lived pretty much till I was 26 in Reno. And you know, I was just a failed musician and a failed writer in Reno. And, you know, my mom was really conservative, and she hated that I was in a band and hated, you know, that I wrote stories or whatever. And so, and it's just hard to be a failure when your mom's around you. So, and I was scared of all the other big cities. You know, I kind of wanted to move to New Orleans, but I didn't have the guts, and I was scared of Los Angeles and San Francisco and Seattle. And I worked at this trucking company, and they had an opening in Portland. And so I moved up to Portland. And there was a band in Portland named Cracker Bash, and they played in Reno one night. And they were a really great band. And they were the lead singer was a super cool guy, a guy named Sean Krogan. And he said, you know, Portland's really great. They have all the houses have basements, so you can practice for free. And if you rent a house, and so I transferred up there, and thank God I did. It was a lucky move, and I met the guys in Richmond Fontaine, and got to be in a real band.
So you were in your mid-20s, you say?
Yeah, I think I was 26, 27 when I got up here. So I wasn't young, man. I loved Reno. There's certain aspects of Reno I just loved, but I didn't want to leave at all. Maybe that's why my first couple books are set in Reno. Because I really didn't want to leave Reno, but I knew to being to be around weirdos and people that like the arts, I had to leave to a different kind of town. And luckily I landed in Portland, which is so great to musicians and writers. I mean, it was like heaven when I moved here.
Right. So then you've your band Richmond Fontaine, did you start the band, or was the band already existing?
Yeah, I started it, and then those guys were lucky or unlucky. We were all lucky, I guess, to find each other. But I always feel kind of guilty because I wrote so many songs that we ended up doing all my tunes, and you know, I'm not the best singer, but we grinded it out for 20 some odd years and had a really nice time. I mean, they're just the coolest guys in the world. I think those guys are.
Well, and you grabbed a couple of them to form the DeLines, right?
Yeah. So I guess in my 50s, I was probably like in my mid 40s. You start seeing, you know, the end of the road. You start saying to yourself, if I want to do something different in my life, I better do it now because I'm running out of time. And I was always uncomfortable being the lead guy in a band, and I don't think I was that good at it. And so a good friend of mine, Amy Boone, from a band called The Damn Nations, which she played in with her sister, we toured together and hung out together. And I really loved her voice. And she did a tour with Richmond Fontaine in the band. And so I wrote her all these songs, hoping that she and I'd start a new band, and it would be kind of late night country soul music, and I would hide in the back in a suit a black suit, so I'd disappear against the black backdrop, and it worked, you know. So she's so cool, and the band's great. I love those guys, and
I have a bit of a crush on Amy Boone, via her voice, you know.
She's got the greatest singing voice and the greatest speaking voice. I could, you know, she could, like, I want to do ads with her selling stuff because she's so great. Yeah, it's really fun. And I, you know, even as a kid, you know, I was trying to be a punk rocker, or whatever. Like we were saying before this, like, I wanted to be in a metal, speed metal band or speed punk kind of hardcore band, but really at home, I just wrote ballads. Even at 12, 13 years old, I was writing like super long, super, super sad ballads. So now I finally just accepted myself, and now I get to just write ballads for this really cool woman to sing.
Yeah. Well, this gets to kind of where I wanted to go, which was, you know, you're one of the few, you know, successful artists who actually are, you know, do both, you know, and do both professionally anyway. I know a lot of writers who, you know, kind of tinker with music on the side, and I'm not sure about the vice versa part. I'm sure there are some, but when you're thinking about in your mind, does the writing, the songwriting and your fiction writing come from the same source? Do you think of it all as a piece?
Yeah, you know, I've always thought of the subject. I've always written about the same sort of subjects. I always wanted, from a really early age, I think maybe the only gift I have, like, I have a nephew who's a shredding guitar player. By the time he was 16, he was three times the guitar player I was. So I have no natural talent, really, except I knew the stories I wanted to tell. And I think from a, you know, 12 or 13, I knew I wanted to tell stories about, like, working class stories. Maybe I read too much Steinbeck or listened to too much of The Jam or The Clash growing up. But I really did know that aspect. I didn't know what that part. And then I think, you know, realistically, I probably would have just been a writer, but I was not great in school, and I don't think I had the confidence to think I had anything to say or I deserved to have anything to say. And so, you know, anybody can get in a band, you know, you just need like a friend and a place to play. And so I wrote songs for years and years and years, and then just wrote stories in secret because I was kind of embarrassed. Because I wasn't a great student, and I didn't want anybody to pick on me over it. So I just kind of kept them to myself. And it wasn't until really I read like Raymond Carver and Larry Brown that I said to myself, wow, you can write about just kind of failed men. And I said, yeah. And I was like, well, I know those stories, and I don't have to do a lot of research for those stories. I don't have to have a lot of confidence to write those stories, because I just know them. And then after I read those kind of guys, I started writing, and like with more ambition, maybe around 18, 19, 20, I started really diving in. And by then I just kind of married the two, the music and the writing, but the writing I kept to myself for another 15 years, maybe till I was 33, 34, 35. I'd written a handful of novels and stuff, but I didn't really show them to anybody, just because I was scared people wouldn't like them.
And so your first published novel was Northline, right?
It was A Motel Life.
Motel Life.
And I just got lucky with that one. You know, my band was starting to do better in the UK, and we were touring over there, and I did an interview with a writer, a really cool crime writer named Stav Shiraz, and he said, I bet you write novels. And I said, well, you know, I do. And he introduced me to his agent, who is still my agent, and she sold The Motel Life. So I got really lucky there.
That's super cool. And kind of, let's just skip forward to the new book, and then we'll kind of go back and forth a little bit. When you say that you were raised in Reno, a lot of it's starting to come into focus, you know, because I think of at least some of your books as Western novels, at least at their heart, you know, especially the last one, Don't Skip Out on Me. Definitely. Do you consider yourself a Westerner, or whatever that means?
I mean, I grew up in love with Nevada. I never lived with my dad, but he was a big Nevada guy. And my mom's boyfriend, the one I live with the most, was obsessed with Nevada and driving around Nevada. Both those guys like driving around Nevada and camping and hunting. And they were just big fans. And my mom was a big fan of like Basque culture.
Okay.
And so we did a lot of like Nevada trips that way. And so I always loved it. And then as I got older, there was a different side of it that I liked, which was I started around 17, 18 when I guess I started realizing that I was kind of a dented guy, that I didn't have much confidence, that I was a little beat up already. I got really attracted to like the drifter side of Reno and the more casino derelicts, I guess, you know, the guys in the old man bars of Reno, which were different than anywhere else. There was a lot of just kind of failed men in Reno. And it really struck something in me, I think, as a kid. I think I was both really frightened that I was going to be one of those guys and also kind of excited that I was going to give up and get to be one of those guys and just accept the fact that I was a bum. Kind of that battle's kind of probably my whole everything I write about is that kind of battle, I think. And so, yeah, I loved Reno for that. I mean, I just loved it to death. I kind of fell in my early 20s. I think I fell in love with it. Like a girl or whatever. I just, you know, I really dug it. And now I've spent my whole life trying not to be one of those guys that you'd walk across in Reno who was 50 and hanging by a thread. But it always attracted me. So yeah, man, I always wanted to write about the West just because I wanted to write about things I loved, and Nevada is one of them.
Yeah, it's funny. When I think of the West, there's part of me that thinks of the Pacific Northwest too, particularly with someone like Carver, you know, because he straddled that line really, really well and wrote about the West. Have you, just by chance, have you read Todd Goldberg's new collection of short stories called The Low Desert?
I'll check it out.
It's killer. Yeah, I mean, he's written this amazing collection of pieces. It's all around, you know, the Salton Sea and that, you know, that area from the Imperial Valley up through Palmdale, just that, all those weird little outposts and, you know, the Indian casinos and you'd love it. I mean, it's really, really good stuff. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about The Night Always Comes. You know, this, in some ways, would you say this is unique in what you've done so far, and that at least I identify a definite noir undertone here amidst everything else that's going on? There's a lot going on in this book.
Yeah, I mean, I keep thinking about The Night Always Comes as a book of panic and desperation. And I think noir is always based in desperate people making desperate decisions. And I think Lynette, the main character in The Night Always Comes, is desperate. And I always think about it, you know, it's like when people are, when you're, I kind of say the same thing, but I think it's true. It's like you're walking down the street and all of a sudden everybody's passing you, like in cars. And you're like, how do they get cars, man? I'm still walking. And you feel like, I better hurry up or I'm going to miss out. It's like a gold rush, say. And I think what you find is Lynette's kind of seeing that happen to her in her life. She's seeing gentrification and coming at such a rapid pace. And she's seeing her city change so rapidly that she starts to panic. And when you meet her, she's in full desperation mode within the first 30 pages. And that's a very noir feel to it. And I wanted it to have that kind of feel. So yeah, I've always been a huge fan of classic noir novels, and those, they've been a huge thing for me. And I've always wanted to write in that vein without the crime part.
Yeah.
This was the first one I did that had the urgency and the kind of the just blatant desperation that noir has.
Now there's a note in the book about, you know, about Portland and how there was this little derelict house. And it was so important for you to buy that damn thing and fix it up. And it was almost like a rite of passage into adulthood in some ways, maybe, I don't know. Can you talk about that house? And is it still standing?
Oh yeah, man, I still own it. Yeah.
You still own it?
Oh yeah, man, it was the first good thing I ever did on my own. I mean, I think I just, maybe things have changed and maybe I'm just getting old. But you know, I was raised to believe that if you had, if you owned a house, you weren't a loser in life. You had succeeded. Like my mom would always say, well, the guy owns a house at least, you know, like he's made something of himself. Because really, if you look at it in the history of mankind, of post-industrialization, having your own piece of property or your own house means you have power. Right. You have savings, you have equity, your feet are planted a little firmer in the world. And so I grew up thinking that, and you know, and again, man, I always struggled with confidence I always imagined myself as a bum. And so when I had an opportunity to buy this house, you know, it was 480 square feet, and none of the plumbing worked. And it was like this guy that lived next door. It was his mother-in-law's little house. They built her, and he was selling it. And it was next to a mini mart. And I bought it. And it did make me feel a lot better about myself, because I said to myself, well, at least I own something. I'm not a complete bum. And it kind of shifted. It shifted something in me. And this is pre-cell phone. I quit. I'd disconnect my phone at 10 so I wouldn't go out. I made myself, you know, because I was like, well, I own a house now, kind of like Tortilla Flat. Yeah. But I own a house now, so I got to be I have to have my shit semi together. It was really fun and one of the greatest things that I did on my own, I guess.
Wow. And so what's going on with it now? Is it somebody yeah, living in it, or?
Is it? I just hang on to it because it was the first good thing I ever did, and I just want to hang on to it to remind myself that I did something good.
So is it housing your vinyl collection, or?
No, man, just my buddy and his girlfriend. It's housing them.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Now, just to kind of catch up. So in the new book, Lynette, when we meet her, I mean, with this book, and especially with the free, you get that exhaustion is just palpable, you know, I mean, she's working two official jobs and a couple of unofficial jobs, or at least one, you know, she's taking care of her a developmentally disabled brother. Was that something, by the way, that came to you right away, the brother?
Well, I was wanting to talk about the burdens that families have, and I hate saying that the brother's a burden, but he's a lot of work. And every family has weight they're carrying, I think, and every family has their kind of scars or their damages that they're trying to keep together enough to keep going. And so I wanted to say, hey, here's a really struggling working class family who have been just kind of limping by their whole journey together. And now you're throwing in this massive gentrification and massive increase in housing prices and rental prices. Your whole city's changing, but you haven't changed. You're still making the same sort of money, and you're still struggling. And now you have to adapt to this new city, which is happening all over the West. And so I wanted the brother in there for that reason, and for a reason to talk about Lynette's, you know, she's basically raised as a kind of a servant to her brother and a servant to her mother. And it's really scarred her up. And it's really been difficult for her as an adult, I think, because she was really always raised to work for her brother and take care of her brother, and wasn't given the right amount of love. And so she's trying to navigate a rough childhood, which so many people have, yet, and still try to do the best she can with how she feels she can do it. It's meaning she doesn't really think outside the box. You know, she's just like, well, I don't have a lot of opportunities, so I'm going to just get another job and I'll work twice as much. I'm still not going to make that much at either of them, but I don't know how people make a lot of money. I don't know anything about IT world. It's like her mother says later on, like, where does somebody get $5,000 to buy a couch or $300 to buy a pair of shoes? Like, how do they figure this shit out? And I think both Lynette and her mom don't understand how to get there. So they just, Lynette in particular, just grinds out with the only things she knows.
And the relationship, I don't want to give any spoilers, but I'm not. The relationship between Lynette and her mother, I thought was just so beautifully done. Did that take a lot of chopping down and reshaping and to get that right?
Yeah, I mean, I took a lot of risks on it, because I think in family sometimes there's that arguments or relationships of any kind that you've known somebody for a lot of years. The arguments should really always be like business discussions, but they're not. They become like one person like picking on the next person oftentimes. I'm always interested in like those little daggers people throw at each other that know each other really well, that really hurt, and they don't stop. They just, it's like, I think of her mom and Lynette together as like the mom is breaking up with her daughter.
Yeah.
From the very beginning of the book, she's trying to like break up with her daughter. And so she's trying to keep her daughter like a boxing match. She's trying to keep her daughter off balance the whole time, so her daughter can't fight back. And so I was interested in that. And I wanted to write a novel where by page 25, you're in this serious argument, in this serious, like really twisty, turny relationship. Because I like those kind of things in novels where it just kind of comes out of left field. And I wanted to see if I could pull off like a big series of arguments between a mother and a daughter that are breaking up, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, you feed us a little bit of Lynette's backstory and, you know, this heartbreak that she's got, you know, been through. You know, there's mental illness, which was really sensitively handled, I thought, and addiction, and you know, all the things that we maybe the cruel inequities of modern life have created, you know, in some ways. Any comments on that kind of thing?
I mean, I think with Lynette, I'm always interested in powerlessness, I yeah. think. And I think with Lynette, there's you know, some people explode and some people implode when they feel powerless. Some people like throw tantrums or get really angry because it, you know, you get angry at somebody, it pushes them back. It kind of recalibrates everything. And if you implode, it's just, you're just taking it out on yourself. And I think Lynette, when she feels like she has no choices left, she explodes. And it's really been difficult for her. You know, I think with her is she was always taking care of her brother, and she was never really got to be a kid. And so she doesn't know how to love. And so you meet her at 30 years old, and here's this person that doesn't really know how to love, doesn't really like herself at all. But it's been going into debt to try to fix herself with therapy, and she's had some real crash and burn moments. But I think, you know, I was really interested in the survival aspect of that. You know, like, she's still really cool and she's just trying to get through and she's pulling out the other side. But that being said, you know, when you've been that rough, have had that rough up and down and emotionally, like mentally ill, man, there's a cost it's paid. I mean, it's hard to be around mentally ill people. I mean, it's tiring and scary, and the rules change and you don't know if they're changing, but you're like, oh shit, the rules just changed. And so I see the mother side too, and it's rough. But yeah, I was interested in all that. I always have been.
Yeah. And so, I mean, the basic setup is that Lynette has this dream. They're offered this old house at a what seems to be a decent price. You know, the landlord's getting ready to get out of it. And so that becomes the focus of her dream. And she saved up all this money, and it's contingent upon mom throwing in her share. And at the, this isn't a spoiler because it's right at the beginning of the book, basically, mom backs out at the last minute. And that, the book takes place over just a couple of days, right? I mean, 2 or 3 days, something like that.
Yeah, 2 days.
Yeah. And so then you're spinned into this hyper desperation mode. And that's when the whole noir sucking down thing kind of starts. But, and so I won't say much more than that about it. But it really is a remarkable book. You know, I've read it twice now, and I keep finding new things in it. There was something else kind of related to that I wanted to ask you. Well, the mom buys a Toyota. Doesn't she buy a brand new Toyota Camry instead?
She bought an Avalon, which is an upgrade of that.
Oh, an Avalon.
I think there's that idea like where you're so tired all the time. I mean, we could talk about that with guitars or whatever. It's like sometimes if you feel like nothing's going right in your life, you're never going to own a house. You're never going to get out of making the kind of money you make. You're never going to be like vacationing in Hawaii. So, you know, why not buy a new guitar? Because it, like, you know, you obsess about it. Or why not? Like the mom says, you know, every day I go to work, everybody passes me in my shitty little Saturn, and they know I'm a loser. And yeah. She goes, I just don't want people to think I'm a loser for once in my life. And so her mom's shooting herself in the foot by getting in debt, buying this car that she shouldn't buy. And Lynette's trying to tell her it means nothing. But to the mom, it's like, you know, I want to at least act like I'm somebody. And it probably will make the mom feel better for a month or two.
Right.
Or maybe 6 months. But then those old bad feelings and those feelings of like, God, I don't have enough hours at this job. What am I going to do for money? I'm always going to be a loser. They come back, and I think Lynette, even by age 30, knows that. She's like, look, mom, you know, this is not going to change anything. You're just destroying your future because you're giving up. And so that was kind of the idea of the mom's kind of giving up. She's saying there's no way we can make it through this gentrification boom, so why even try? So don't act like you're good enough to buy this house. And also the house is, you know, next to a freeway, and it's It's a tear down house, and it's, you know, basically $300,000, and they're getting a deal on it. The funny thing is when I wrote it, started writing this book, I think it was 4 years ago, and I did $280,000, $300,000, say, and now that same house would be maybe $400,000. So it's gone up in just 4 years. It's gone up $100,000, which is just fucking insane.
You know, it's fun.
Because the house I'm talking about is worse than the house that I bought for $70,000 20 years ago. I mean, it's, you know, it's one of those houses that, you know, would be torn down.
Right. It's funny. Phoenix is just going crazy right now. And my wife and I were lucky enough, just dumb luck. We bought in 2009. You know, this cool old 1920s house downtown. And at that time, you know, copper was really high valued at that. So people, the tweakers were stealing copper, and our house had all the copper stripped out of it, the house we wanted to buy. And it was a bank owned property. And we went in there and got it for a song. And now it's like 2.5 times what we paid for it. And it's like, you know, but
like it just makes you feel more secure in your life. You're like, hey, I did something good. And you just, like in life in general, man, like if you get a couple lucky breaks, then you kind of keep going. And then if you get hit in the legs too many times, you stop trying. And I think a lot of the issues of the book is to try or not to try, where Lynette feels like she still feels like she can get that old school American dream. And she can have security for her brother and her mom, and her mom's like disillusioned. Her mom's like been beat up in life, and her mom's had some bad breaks, and her mom just can't try anymore. And I was really interested in that idea, like if her mom could just like take a pause and say, look, I this is a good investment for all of us. But again, her mom's tired of living with Lynette and would rather, you know, go down in flames than live in that same place. So it's heartbreaking in that regard.
Yeah. And she's, mom's seen her own opportunities kind of dwindle away throughout the years. Yeah. Man. Yeah. So let's just buy guitars. I mean,
yeah. Well, like the guy in my band, Richmond Fontaine, his name's Dan Eccles. He's one of my best friends and a really, really cool dude. He just said, "Will, you don't need to buy another guitar. You just need to be better at the guitar you do own." You're like, "Man, you hear that? You know, can't I just buy another guitar?" And he's like, "Nah, you just got to be a better guitar player."
Where's the fun? Where's the fun in that?
Yeah. Well, you've got a point, man. I think about that daily and about most things. You know, I just got to work harder, and you know, you can't buy your way out of shit. You know.
Well, you know, it's interesting to say, you know, that you've suffered from your own kind of self-doubt over the years. You know, you've brought that up several times, and it's like, what kind of advice do you have for, you know, aspiring writers who might be watching, who feel like they don't have approval to do it, you know?
The thing about writing is you can fail in private. I mean, it's a very lonely, like, it's really fun if you can publish them, because I mean, it's scary to put them out in the world, and some people aren't going to like them and beat them up and all that. But you have a mission, and you have a little bit more confidence. The reason I didn't send books out for whatever 17 years is because I was scared they would say I sucked, and then you're like, well, what's there's no, if you know you're bad at something, you're probably not going to get up early before work and write on a story. So I don't have a lot of, you know, my thing is like the act of disappearing into a story was so much fun. Like living in Reno and writing about Reno was so fun. I felt it was like some of the best times, even though my stories were often difficult, it was my favorite thing to do. So my take to writers is if you can disappear into a world that you read that makes your life better or is a great escape, then don't worry about the rest of it. Cause that in itself, it's a lot cheaper than buying a car to make yourself feel better. And you can, You can get it on with anyone. You can kill anyone. You can drink as much as you want or eat as much as you want. And you can live in Hawaii if you want, or in Turkey or Greece. You can do anything you want, and it's free. You just get to, and you're not, unlike being in a shitty band where everybody's pissed at you all the time. Your neighbors are mad. Whoever you're living with is mad. Writing, you're just quiet in a corner, and you get to disappear and be in a world that feels right to you. So that for me was always the big battle for me with publishing was, you know, if I get published and it's, and people really beat up on it, well, you know, will I still want to go hide out in the world that I created? So it's all about the work really, and not about anything else.
Now I know that, you know, before you've been able to kind of concentrate on your writing and music full time, I know it's been a long time now, but you worked some shitty ass jobs, didn't you?
I mean, I just worked manual labor jobs. You know, I never was a
your house painter.
I was a house. I worked for trucking companies mostly before house painting. I just worked for like TNT Best, which is like trucking companies loading trucks. I worked for a chemical company loading chemicals. And then my best job was a house painter. I just worked in warehouses and house painting was my best job by far because I made the most money, and eventually I got to start my own business and went out on my own. And then I could write, you know, in the morning and show up at 10 o'clock and not get fired. You know, my whole life was trying to find time to, you know, to where I could make enough money, but still have time enough to write. But I just worked those kind of jobs because I was, back then I was so shy. I couldn't talk to people. And so I couldn't work in restaurants. I couldn't work in anything where there was like a retail or public things because I couldn't talk to people. So I just worked in warehouses and loaded trucks, which you don't really have to talk, which, you know, kind of saved my ass and kept me down. It kind of beat me up and saved me at the same time.
I don't think I've asked you this. You wrote a wonderful short story for that anthology a couple of years ago that I was lucky enough to be involved with, The Highway Kind. And you introduced me to Patterson Hood, who wrote a killer story. But in your story, which is about a guy who's a house painter, there's a guy who works with him, who is constantly kind of not showing up and sort of self-destructing. Is he based on a real person?
No, man. He was a jab. I used to hire this old friend of mine and to paint with me. You know, I used to hire guys just so I would show up. I didn't really care about how much work they did. I just hired him to make sure I would show up. Because, you know, if you hired a guy, you got to be there at 8 o'clock. And, you know, if it was a like scraping a house or doing something I didn't want to do, I had a list of guys I would hire just so I would show up and work. And if they put in 3 or 4 hours of an 8-hour day, I'd be all right. But I had this old school friend of mine. They would always, like when he knew he was working for me, he would party all night the night before, and then he'd show up so hungover he couldn't do anything. So a lot of time he'd be on like the drop cloth, you know, laying in like the fetal position or just saying, or spending all day apologizing that he couldn't work. So it was kind of that guy. But, you know, in house painting, you run into a lot of guys that are kind of either on the way up or on the way down as far as boozing. And so I threw that in there. The funny thing about that story, Kill Switch, is I just wrote a novel based on it with those characters in it. During COVID, I wanted to write something that felt safe and something that I could have a lot of fun with. And so I just wrote a novel based on those characters called Rust. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That's exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really fun. I mean, I don't know if anyone will like it, but there's a lot of derelict house painters in it.
Cool. And is the Le Mans figure into it?
Not new, not a little bit, but not much, but a little bit. It's in there.
Right.
Thank you for that opportunity. It's a really cool book, and I was really excited to get to be a part of it.
Oh yeah, I was super stoked. You know, I'd love to see Patterson. I was considering, maybe I should have. I was considering reaching out to him and seeing if he would, as a surprise to you, show up partway through this. But have you been in touch with him recently, and is he writing?
I think he's working on, he's always working on like kind of a memoir thing or a history of his songs, I think, if I remember correctly. I could be screwing that up. But I don't know. I mean, the guy's one of the hardest working songwriters I've ever met. And one of the, he was probably one of the cooler guys I've ever met, really, in my life. I haven't seen him that much this year at all. Maybe only twice, but he's one of my biggest inspirations. I think that guy's just so damn smart and cool, and he's got such a open mind about things. And as I get older, I'm starting to get more cynical. And so just learning from him and thinking about how he thinks about things makes life easier.
Do you find yourself, as I do in some ways, you know, seeing myself have elements of that get off my lawn kind of personality kind of creeping in? I try to keep it at bay, but.
I mean, I guess I grew up with really right-wing household, like really claustrophobically, really angry and increasingly angry. That's my biggest fear, I think, is to be like that. So I try really, really hard not to be like that. But you can see how people get like that. I just am praying to God I don't, you know.
I know. Yeah.
I don't want to, you know, I think it's okay to be a little bit get off my lawn, but you can do a TV all day and just yelling at it.
Yeah.
You grew up and I don't want to be that guy.
No, definitely not. Well, I'm just kind of watching it. Some of the people who are writing in, and our good friend Craig Johnson, great writer.
I've read all those books, and you know, I listened to George Godall read them. Godall, I think it is. When I can't sleep, I listen to him. And that guy, man, he's so good at reading Craig's stuff, and. And so it's really fun to read a book and then to listen to it and to have a master like that guy read them. It's just brilliant.
Yeah, Craig's such a great guy. And he's been so supportive of your work, too. Terrific.
Really nice to me.
Good dude. Let's see. Not too many specific questions. Most people are just saying how much they love your book. A couple of people are... or love your books. A couple of people are weighing in that have already read the new book and liked it. Barbara has a question. She says, your characters are complex people. Do they stick with you after the book is finished?
Yeah, I think the one that, a few of them do, you know, for different reasons. But the one that kills me is Horace Hopper from Don't Skip Out of Me, my last book. Just saying that kid's name breaks my heart. He was probably one of my favorite things, the favorite book I've done, because I like that kid so much. I relate to that kind of guy so much. That's still saying that name or seeing the name Horace, which I named after Horace McCoy, because he wrote they shoot horses, don't they?
Yeah.
And there are times, because I've been talking about Lynette so much lately, that I really worry about it. Like, you start worrying about him, like, I'm really worried about her by the end of the book. Like, what's going to happen after the end of the book? Is she going to be okay? And is she tough to make it in life? And I do. They do stay with me. I always think of them as kind of saints. They keep, like, a dented guy like me afloat. I mean, to go to sleep at night and knowing you have Horace Hopper and Lynette in your head, and the Flanagan brothers and Allison Johnson and Charlie Thompson from Lean On Pete, just knowing that they're kind of your pals and they're beat up too, but they're okay. It sounds silly, but it makes me get through, you know.
Didn't you say that that Horace Hopper, AKA Hector Hidalgo, was kind of an homage to David Hidalgo?
Yeah, well, you know.
For the name anyway.
We had a black velvet painting in the rehearsal space in the basement where Richard Fontaine practiced for, maybe 10 years of our 20 years. We rehearsed in our bass player's basement. And we had this guy we called Hector Hidalgo because we all love Los Lobos so much. And he was like a Mexican bandito. It was super tough. And it was mine. I bought it. So when we switched rehearsal spaces, I took him home and I had him on my wall. And he just looks at me every day and he says, like, don't be a wimp, you know, because he's super tough. So I always put like beautiful women across from him so he can see beautiful women like Myrna Loy or someone like that. So he can look at him. And then and he always tells me, like, to be, you know, shape up, man, be a man for once. Stop crying in your boots, buddy. And but yeah, his last name was for David Hidalgo, who's one of my favorite singers and songwriters. And I mean, man, that guy can play guitar and accordion, and
he really is a national treasure. I think actually all those guys are
one of the coolest bands, really one of the coolest bands, I think. And I've always been, you know, since I remember where I bought their second record, How Will the Wolves Survive. I was, you know, like a junior in high school. I remember running around in a gym in PE singing Last Night I Got Loaded on a Bottle of Gin, that old soul tune. So they were brilliant at mixing like Americana, old blues, soul, like traditional Mexican music. They could like interweave it. They're great, man. They're just the coolest.
Kind of a, you know, Sun Records era rock and roll.
They can do that as well. I mean, they can do anything, and they can play like the Grateful Dead, and they can do, you know, Almond kind of stuff. I mean, those guys are just old school, real musicians.
Yeah, I love the one that they did. Let's see, La Pistola y el Corazón. You know, the one that's all in Spanish. I love that album.
That's a brilliant album, man. Just brilliant. Yeah.
We saw them a couple of years ago, my wife Sandra and I, at they played out here in Chandler, and they accompanied a Mexican folklorico dance troupe. It was the coolest thing, you know. And they were providing the musical accompaniment, and so they had this folklorico dance troupe. It was really cool.
And then David Hidalgo has been, you know, years ago did stuff with Mark Ribot. They toured together, like two guitar wizards. And I could go on and on about them. They're just the coolest, just the coolest.
Right. Well, who were some of your, you mentioned the Carver and Steinbeck and some of those influences. Who are some of your main musical influences?
I mean, I think growing up, I liked it, you know, like anybody, I love it all. I think, like, you know, at an early age, I was pretty open to all different kinds of music. And I, you know, I was kind of raised to think that anything could be good. And it's not your job to be mean to what you don't understand. It's your job to figure out what's going on in that. So as a little kid, I would love to, like, I loved like Springsteen and Yes and Rush. And then I think as I got more, like, as you start growing up and you realize you're kind of like, well, I just struggled a lot. Let's just say that as a kid. Then bands like The Replacements and Husker Du and those kind of like depressive working class rock, I guess you'd call that in a way, but, you know, kind of punk, that really moved me and really kind of ruined me.
I remember the last time you were out here, you said, we had a talk about The Replacements. You're like, yeah, man, The Replacements let me down.
Well, The Replacements are a dangerous band for, they're a dangerous band for a burgeoning alcoholic kid who hates himself and it's going right. That story I told you was just The Replacements opening for Tom Petty. And I worked at a car wash, and I'd worked 13 days straight to save money for it, because I was dating this gal and I was going to take her on this big night out. And that was when The Replacements were just horrible. And she was a true punk rocker. And so she was like, we were kids, you know, I was like 20 with a fake ID kind of guy. And I was like, they're the greatest band. And she goes, they're just making fun of you. You work 13 days straight to take me out tonight. and they're so drunk and they're making, and then they made fun of Tom Petty. And even though she was a serious punk rocker, she loved Petty. And and she goes, you can't like a band that makes fun of Tom Petty. And then I went down to get their shirts because it was the first time I knew they were going to have replacement shirts. And they were like $14 back then, which is like, fuck, it's like $50 now. And it was, and it just was dollar bills, like $10 bill for Paul Westerberg and so forth. And I couldn't buy it, man. I just couldn't do it. And I went back to her and I said, man, I don't understand. Why would they put dollar bills on it? It's not that cool a shirt. And she said, oh, they're just making fun of you for spending that kind of money on a shirt. And after that, I was, and then, you know, they get off stage or whatever. And then Tom Petty comes on and the whole night's brilliant. And you're happy and in love again and all that shit. So, but I love the Replacements. I like them. And I think around 17, I fell in love with I guess it was before that. I guess I was like 14. I bought Swordfish Trombones by Tom Waits. And it scared me so bad, I had to sell it back to the store because I didn't want it in my house because it scared me. But I loved Jonesburg, Illinois, the ballad, so much that I had to go back to that same fucking dude at the record store and buy the record back because I had to hear one song. And the beauty of back then with records is you listen to one song, and then I had a soldier sing on the other side of the record that I liked the two ballads. And then before you know, you like three songs or four songs. And I think Tom Waits became probably one of my biggest influences after that, after Swordfish Trombones, because I got to go back and get his earlier catalog. So, you know, I like all kinds of stuff, but as a kid, Tom Waits really, really rocked my world, I guess, and shifted my ideas of what you could write songs like as a guy and in a rock and roll way, because he writes ballads, man. He writes classic ballads.
It's funny because, you know, I loved Tom Waits for a long time. And, you know, for the longest time, I was not ready for his real avant-garde stuff. You know what I mean? I loved Closing Time. I loved The Heart of Saturday Night. You know, I love those, all those wonderful early albums. But now, for some reason, some switch has turned in my brain. And I love all the crazy shit that he's done, too. You know?
Yeah, it just depends. It's just avant-garde is just harder. You got to be in the right frame of mind. It's like really hard, like hard bop kind of jazz. Like you just got to be in the right frame of mind. Or you'll stick your head through a window. And sometimes with some weird Tom Waits weirder stuff, if you're not in the right mood, it can drive you nuts. But it's cool to have it, and it just shows you that he's just following. He's just going down his own weird hole and finding all these little branches to go off into, and it's exciting. And if I could be so brave, you know.
Let's see here. We'll wrap it up here in just a second. Let's see. Nicholas asks, he says, when writing first drafts, do you stick very close to a beat sheet, or do you just disappear into it?
I don't know what a beat sheet is, but what I could do is I could tell you over a cup of coffee what the story is about. I could write a poem about the novel. Like I could tell you the overall arc of what Lynette and The Night Always Comes is. I don't know a lot of the stuff in the middle, but I kind of know the beginning and the end. And then I just kind of go for it off that. And then the thing I like about writing is the first draft just means you get the rest of your life to fix it. So I always think about it like you just bought a bad car that doesn't start, and now you have to figure out, and you're not a very good mechanic, and then but no one's pressing time on you, and you have all the money in the world to fix it, but you got to fix it yourself. And so then I just tinker on it and tinker on it and tinker on it. But generally, like the soul of the book, I'll know when I start it. Gotcha. The soul will start landing.
Let's see. Okay. Barbara asks, she says, were you a big reader as a child? And what is a favorite childhood book that you really was really important to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think my grandmother was an English teacher, and probably my favorite relative, I guess you'd say, or besides my brother and my aunt, probably my favorite people, you know, growing up. And so she always gave me books. So yeah, I read a lot, but I just read like James Bond, you know, as a kid. My favorite book was My Side of the Mountain, about a kid that runs away and lives in a tree with a falcon. And I always wanted to be that kid, but I never had guts to leave. But I read just like, whatever my mom had, which were just like crime books or James Bond books or John D. McDonald. I read a lot of that stuff. And then my grandfather gave me a Count of Monte Cristo. And I think that's what really kind of rocked me and kind of changed my life. And that and school, from middle school till I graduated from high school, I'd read most of Steinbeck's novels in school. He was just really popular in my high school. And so I read him and I really bought into that, the whole workers' rights and my mom was a single mom and really worked hard and got sexually harassed and passed over for jobs. And she'd come home and tell us all about it every night. And so I really wanted to, that was really important to me to write those kind of stories. So maybe Steinbeck. So yeah, I liked novels and movies and records as a kid. I've not changed at all much since I was a kid that way.
Nancy says, how can anyone not like Petty? And she's right. You know, he's pretty universally liked, Tom Petty.
Classic songwriter. And he's the guy that you spend 13 days working at a car wash. I was living in Austin, Texas at the time, and I didn't even know what humidity was. And I moved to Austin in the summer, that just shows you how bright I am. And I worked 13 days straight to see him, and it was worth it. You know, like Petty's just worth it. He's a classic songwriter, and his band always put on a good show. And he's the guy that you waste your life to afford to buy tickets to see him, and then you're happy you did. So yeah, I can't say enough good things about Petty.
It's funny how your experience mirrors mine exactly when it comes to, I wasn't trying to impress a date, but the same tour came through Phoenix and they played at the University Activity Center, The Replacements opening for Petty. And it was a friggin' disaster, man. Yeah, it's they must have just, the whole tour must have been a train wreck.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, I thought they were cool for that when you're now playing punk rock clubs. But it's a different deal when you're having to fork out big money to see a band. Yeah. And they're like, they're your big purchase for maybe 3 months. And so I think at that point, you kind of have to show up, I mean, I remember, that's all I'll say on that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll wrap it up here. I threw on, that being said, I threw on Hootenanny. I've had that album since I was a teenager and I hadn't listened to it in several decades. And I threw it on and I was amazed at how good it sounded, you know, because a lot of the real hardcore punk stuff doesn't age particularly well. That stuff sure did.
I mean, I think Let It Be by The Replacements is one of the great records.
Oh yeah.
I mean, it's just remarkable. And he's a brilliant songwriter. So, I love the band to death. I mean, they're great. They're just a bad band to take your girl to and blow whatever I blew that night, $150-$200 on, you know?
Yeah. Well, what are you listening to these days? I know you're a very eclectic listener.
Well, right now I'm just, I'm in my, because we just did a soundtrack for the new book, I was in my, a Winged Victory for the Solent, that kind of ambient stuff. I guess in general, I've been just listening to a lot of like whale noise music. but I've also been really into, I've always liked Kamasi Washington.
Yeah.
Like the Epic, I think, is a really cool record. And I didn't know much about Thundercat, the bass player who's got records out. So I've been listening to a lot of him lately. And he's just a really out there, really genius guy. So I've been listening to him all day. And then one of the guys in Fontaine just told me to revisit Joni Mitchell because he's on a big Joni Mitchell kick. So all day I was listening to Joni Mitchell. who I kind of missed growing up. So just, I'm all over the map that way. What about you?
Same, just all over the place. Still kind of exploring that weird German stuff.
Yeah, man, the German prog rock stuff's out there and really amazing.
Yeah. So the Popol Vuh.
Musicians there are in every country and in every era.
Yeah. Getting back to some of the old Delta blues stuff, which never goes too far away.
Yeah.
But I'm getting a too much music and not enough book talk comment.
Okay, yeah, sorry.
It's from a friend of mine, so that's okay. Well, anyway, sorry to keep you so long, but it's always a treat to get a chance to talk to you, Willie. And congratulations on the new book. It's just a killer.
Oh, thanks. And Poison Pen is one of the great bookstores. So hopefully when everything COVID lifts up, people coming to Phoenix for whatever reason will come stop by and check it out. Because it is, like, I remember that time I did a reading there, I was just blown away how amazing it was. If you like mystery or crime or noir, it's heaven.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Have the DeLines ever played Arizona?
No, man. You know, we've only toured Europe. I don't think we haven't done any U.S. tours. I think we get these offers to play in Europe, and they're kind of fun, and everybody will get in the van. And I think in the States, it's harder to get everybody in the van, and it just seems more. It brings back those old memories of touring for years when no one liked you. So it's hard. It's hard to get people in the van. So we'll see. I don't know if we'll ever tour the States, to be honest.
Well, hope someday to see you guys out here.
But, yeah, man.
Yeah. All right, Willie. Well, you have a great night. And thanks, everybody, for watching tonight. And we still have a handful of signed copies left of the new book here. But I'm going to hit Willie up for some more. So I'll put that link in the comments field. But thanks again, man. I'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thank you. I really had a good time. It's good seeing your face and catching up.
You too.
All right, man. See you.
Good night.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.